This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm news director Sarah Bohannon. Today, it's Virus 101 on this show, as NSPR's Blue Dot host Dave Shlom checks in with a Chico State virologist about what we've learned since this pandemic started. He'll ask questions like, how long can the virus live on surfaces? Is 6 feet enough to stay safe when social distancing? And do we know if this virus is seasonal? We'll also hear from NSPR's Up the Road host, Kim Weir, about a delivery service dropping off groceries for your pets. If you have a story you want to hear, leave us a message on our message line, 433-9216, or go to our website, mynspr.org. For Friday, April 17th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. Last month, we learned a lot about the novel coronavirus and viruses in general when NSPR's Dave Shlom spoke with Troy Klein, assistant professor of biological sciences who teaches virology at Chico State. But of course, a lot of things have changed since a month ago, and people studying this virus have learned a lot. So we've brought back both Dave and Troy to learn what new findings are out there. Dave kicked the conversation off by asking if there have been any updates on how long the novel coronavirus can live on various surfaces.
Yeah, there was a paper published with a collaboration between scientists at UCLA and Princeton and a federal laboratory in Montana. And they demonstrated that survival of the virus in the environment depends on the surface that the virus is on. So they were able to recover infectious virus from a plastic or a stainless steel surface for up to 3 days after applying the virus to that surface, whereas infectious virus only lasted on a copper or a cardboard surface for several hours or up to a day.
Okay, because I think, you know, what concerns a lot of people is, you know, that Amazon package they get on their porch and things
right.
like that.
Yeah, and so your Amazon package is probably a cardboard surface.
Yeah.
So the virus seems to have low stability on a cardboard surface, but I saw a picture last night of a woman picking up a cardboard package from her porch with kitchen tongs. So if that's what you want to do to feel better and you can manipulate the kitchen tongs to do that for you, then go for it.
Sure. And how about the idea of once you've gotten the virus, you know, maybe you were asymptomatic or you had a mild case or worse. Do we have any information on whether you can be reinfected?
Yeah. So interestingly, there are a number of cases of potential reinfection being reported now in China and South Korea and possibly Japan. So these are people who would have tested positive for the virus, recovered from illness, tested negative for the virus, and have now tested positive again. So there are a couple of potential explanations for this, and it isn't clear yet which of these is correct. But one explanation is that these individuals did not mount a long-lasting antibody response and thus were vulnerable to reinfection. There is also evidence of three different strains of the virus circulating in different parts of the world, so it's possible that people can experience disease a second time if they are reinfected with a different strain than they were initially exposed to. That would require that antibodies generated against the first virus don't offer protection against the second. And whether that is in fact the case, whether that happens, has not yet been demonstrated experimentally. And then a third possibility is that the tests that showed these patients had cleared the virus were false negative results, meaning that the patient in fact had not cleared the virus. So maybe the test was faulty, the sample wasn't collected correctly, or maybe the patient was still harboring a very low level of virus that could not be detected by the test. There are a number of reasons for that, but in that last scenario, what we're looking at wouldn't actually be a reinfection.
Because I've seen a lot of people, you know, pinning their hopes perhaps on using the antibodies collected from people's
right.
blood or plasma or however that works. Maybe you could explain that that have had the disease and using that. Could you explain to us, you know, what do we know about that so far?
Sure. So from what I know, there is evidence that, so this would be called convalescent serum. So serum from an individual who was infected, recovered from illness, It has antibodies in that serum that then can be administered passively to another infected individual, and those antibodies could neutralize virus in the treated individual and treat the infection in that individual. And I believe this has been done in a few cases. I don't know where or how extensively it's been done. But to the extent that that works, and that would suggest that there are people for whom an antibody response is generated, and that is a protective antibody response. I think it's quite likely that at least for the short term, so for some period of time after you've been infected, you do have antibodies that would protect against reinfection and could help another individual who is sick.
So my next question I have for you is, you know, we heard all along that if you were 6 feet away, you know, that was ideal to stay away from people by at least 6 feet. What do we know now? Because I'm starting to hear that, you know, it could be quite a bit more distance. And then another question I have for you, let's say I'm walking my dogs and there's a runner in front of me and there's a breeze blowing and I'm downwind from them by, you know, 20, 30, 40 feet. What do we know about how airborne this virus is and how far away you really need to be safe?
So that one, gosh, I'm not entirely sure what the science behind the justification for that 6 foot social distancing space is. I suspect that perhaps they had to balance the science on how far respiratory droplets can travel with what is really achievable in a public setting, like a grocery store mm-hmm. or a doctor's office, where a whole lot more than 6 feet just may not be feasible.
Yeah. But what about outside? How far away would you want to be?
Right. So, you know, I've found myself personally, this is probably not a good thing. Personally, as the weeks have gone by, the anxiety has worn off a bit. And I find myself not quite as anxious if I'm at the grocery store or on a walk in the park. Oh. But I think about it periodically. And I was at the grocery store this morning, and I try to keep that 2 shopping cart distance between myself and other people when that's possible. As my wife and I have been walking, we will cross the street and go to the other sidewalk if somebody is approaching us. And particularly, we'll do that if the people approaching are older individuals who are in that more vulnerable age group, so that we don't risk, you know, if we are carrying the virus unknowingly, we don't risk exposing them.
Okay. And I was at the grocery store yesterday and everything went well in the store, got out to the parking lot. And then suddenly this homeless guy who looked to be not doing very well at all, I would say, you know, as far as his mental faculties go and hygiene, you know, just started approaching me in the parking lot. And it was just the level of panic I felt was just like, you know, I basically yelled at him to keep his distance. He wound up walking by, but I was glad I had a mask on.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Glad, good thing to have a mask on. And, you know, we get into those situations.
It was really literally something like out of a horror movie. Something, you know, the guy looked like he was right out of central casting for being a zombie.
That's too bad. My wife and I were in Target last week, and a student that she taught last semester or a year ago in a microbiology class works at Target, and this student saw my wife and was very excited to see her, and she said, "I want to run up and give you a hug, but we won't do that." And so,
well, that's good.
My wife was.
Okay, last question. It's been about a month since we talked to you last. What are some of the things that you have learned in the past month? Anything come to mind that you know now that you didn't know then?
Yeah. So what I've really been drawn to is the stories, the data that are emerging about the origin of this virus, how it came to spill over from bats into humans, and how the virus is changing as it circulates in humans. So these things aren't directly related to public health response, what we're doing every day to deal with the pandemic. It doesn't really deal with antiviral drugs or vaccines. But for me, these are the really interesting stories, and I've incorporated these stories into my class. And one that really stands out, which is quite recent, is this gets into the weeds of the science a little bit, but there's a short, moderately sized deletion of the viral genome that has been detected in 8 patients in Singapore. And what's interesting about that deletion is that towards the end of the SARS coronavirus outbreak in 2002 and 2003, that coronavirus also started showing a deletion in a region of the genome. And for the SARS coronavirus, that deletion actually attenuated the virus, meaning it was less robust at replicating in human cells. And so it's interesting to see a similar deletion popping up in SARS coronavirus 2 now, and it'll be interesting to see if this virus variant spreads beyond Singapore. Is it going to be able to compete with viruses that retain that sequence? Is it signaling, perhaps in a similar way, sort of a tipping point in this pandemic, where we're going to come starting on the downturn of infections and illness? So those are all open questions, but the appearance of that deletion in the genome is something that I'm watching closely.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, last question. We're headed into late spring and summer, and you know, a lot of people are just hoping that this is going to go away as it gets hotter. Could you comment on how some viruses, like the flu, influenza, are seasonal and they do go away in the summertime? We don't, you know, usually have to worry about the flu in the summer. What do we know about this virus in terms of, you know, summertime temperatures and seasonality?
Yep. So influenza virus has been the best studied model for the role of temperature and humidity and other environmental factors on virus transmission. And there are important similarities between influenza viruses and coronaviruses in terms of structure, virus structure, and transmission route that suggest that what we know about influenza viruses may apply to the coronaviruses. So the strongest experimental data that we have supports the idea that the most favorable conditions for influenza virus transmission via respiratory droplets are cold and dry conditions. So low temperature, low relative humidity. And those are the conditions that we move around in during the winter. And it is believed that that then explains the wintertime seasonality of influenza virus transmission. And the mechanism of that is believed to be that stability of the virus particle deteriorates as conditions warm and become more humid. So at low, and also conditions, environmental conditions also impact the chemistry and the physics of the respiratory droplets. At low humidity, respiratory droplets lose water, and that allows them to be suspended in the air for a longer period of time, and that facilitates virus transmission. So for the coronaviruses, I guess nobody really knows the answer, but if they're going to act like influenza viruses, then transmission via respiratory droplets may in fact decrease during the warmer months.
What about hot and dry conditions? You know, because like, you know, for example, here in the western United States, we have much hotter, drier weather than, say, on the East Coast, where it's hot and humid. Anything you could comment on there?
So the influenza virus model has been best studied to address the question of the role of temperature and humidity on virus transmission through respiratory droplets. And there are similarities between influenza viruses and the coronaviruses in terms of virus structure and transmission route. So this would suggest that what we know about influenza may apply to the coronaviruses. So the strongest experimental data that we have supports the idea that the most favorable conditions for influenza virus transmission via respiratory droplets are cold temperatures and the relative effect of absolute humidity versus relative humidity aren't quite as well worked out. So the mechanism is believed to be that the stability of a virus particle in the environment deteriorates as conditions warm. So under warmer temperatures, virus stability is not as great, and transmission through respiratory droplets is not as easy because those respiratory droplets don't remain suspended in the air as long. So while there is some hope that warmer temperatures will decrease virus transmission in the summer, remember that the influenza virus that went pandemic in 2009 saw some of its most aggressive spread in June and July, so we really don't know what to expect. But whatever happens with this virus over the summer, we also need to prepare now for the potential of a resurgence in the fall and next winter.
Troy Klein is an assistant professor in the biology department at Chico State and teaches a class about infectious viruses. He spoke with NSPR's host of Blue Dot, Dave Shloem. You're listening to special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. When you can't leave your house, delivery is key. And in this pandemic, a lot is being delivered. Books, groceries, even pet supplies. NSPR's Kim Weir has more.
There's nothing quite like total global disaster to point out how fragile our castles are, the ones we've built to shelter our hopes and dreams. They seem so sturdy. But then comes an earthquake or megafire or a disease pandemic, and the walls come tumbling down. So here we are, sheltering in place, looking out at all the rubble, those of us who aren't out in the thick of it. And if we're lucky, we have a dog or cat or other critters to keep us company while we collectively figure out how to rebuild. But how do we feed our furry, feathered, and scaly friends? Maybe now we suddenly can't afford pet food. Or we're unable or afraid to go out and get what our pets need because we're at high risk for the coronavirus and need to stay home. Where I live in Butte County, the answer is call the Butte Humane Society, an organization with serious experience dealing with disaster and its impacts on pets. Overnight, for example, Butte Humane's long-running pet food and supply pantry has been transformed into a door-to-door delivery system. The pet food pantry has been an option for low-income pet owners since 2015, but this emergency community outreach didn't fully come into its own until after the campfire. As Butte Humane's executive director, Katrina Woodcox, explains,
the pet food pantry exploded. I think we probably, the first 4 or 5 months, thousands and thousands of people and provided them with donated pet food and supplies.
Now, in response to the coronavirus crisis and its impacts, the program has become the Pet Food and Supply Pantry Express. If you qualify, and if they have what you need, they will deliver it right to your doorstep.
We created the Pet Food Pantry Express with the intention early on to get food to folks who are health compromised that couldn't leave their home or didn't have a loved one or a friend or family member to bring them pet food. But then quickly we realized so many people were losing jobs, becoming financially strapped. So we just opened it up to anybody in need in Butte County, whether they are unable to leave their home for health reasons or whether they're just in need because they lost their job or they're, you know, in a financial crisis.
The Pet Food Pantry Express delivers throughout Butte County twice a week, on Wednesdays and Saturdays. A generous donation from the greater good jump-started its door-to-door delivery program, Woodcock says. But community members can help, too, to keep the program going at least through the mandated period for sheltering in place, to support people who are struggling, which often includes struggling to keep their pets.
We can at least provide food for their animals and give them one more reason to be able to keep their animals rather than have to surrender or let go of their animals. It's no human contact, so we basically deliver it to your doorstep. We have folks call in, leave a message, and then a volunteer will call you back and get your information and then schedule a delivery for you. And the number that they can call for the Pet Food Pantry Express is 530-966-2902. And of course, any information regarding Humane Society, adopting, volunteering, fostering, and the Pet Food Pantry can be found at buttehumane.org.
Even in these distanced times, the Butte Humane Society has had great success fostering and placing its shelter animals. Within a week after California's coronavirus shelter-in-place order, almost all of its animals were in foster homes. Then, Butte Humane created a distanced adoption process with all standard questions and procedures handled online or over the phone. Only at the end, when a shelter staff member meets the adopter in person, is there human-to-human physical contact, appropriate masked and gloved and socially distanced contact.
And it's been really successful. We're really pleased to be able to provide that service. We've adopted out close to 60 animals since the shelter-in-place mandate was put into place on the 20th of March, which is really outstanding.
How can you help? If you can afford it, donate online to keep the kibble and kitty litter flowing. Go to buttehumane.org for that and for other details. And if you live elsewhere and want to help closer to home, reach out to local animal shelters to support similar pet food pantries and to encourage online foster and adoption programs so your neighbors can continue to provide shelter for their pets. Having extra time for our pets, to connect with newcomers, and to be newly amused by longtime companions turns out to be one positive result of our need to shelter in place. Let's make the most of it, for us and for them.
That story by NSPR's host of Up the Road, Kim Weir. Like Kim noted, there is nothing quite like total global disaster to point out how fragile our castles are. And there is also nothing quite like a total global disaster to connect our little kingdoms together. While yes, there has clearly been some serious differences of opinion, and there's been divide during this pandemic, there has also been so much unification all over the world. So much kindness and support and caring for one another. And all of this has been done in really creative ways as we work to feel together while we're apart. Things like putting teddy bears in windows so kids have something new to look at or to find during a walk or drive with their families. Or creating a Facebook page where people can share a view of what they see every day from their window while they're isolating. Or arranging group applauses in neighborhoods to show support for medical workers who continue putting their lives on the line during this pandemic. Which brings me to one such act, actually by medical workers, from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. They wanted to let their colleagues and patients know that they were there for them. So they got together virtually to sing a song. Each of them recorded their piece of the song individually, and then it was edited together later. Here they are with their rendition of Bruno Mars' Count on Me.
I'll be the light. forget how much you really mean to me.
And that is your program. If you have any thoughts for us, leave them on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is special coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30. Or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and let's keep using our imagination and resourcefulness to take care of each other.